We've been asking the question, the probing, haunting question, why? Why did they execute Jesus of Nazareth? In a book entitled The Quiet Revolution by James Smart, he makes this observation. We always find it difficult to understand why anyone would hate or fear Jesus sufficiently to desire his death, and especially why religious and political leaders would bypass the ordinary processes of justice in their eagerness for his death. He had injured no man. The one purpose for which he lived was to help his fellow man at the two points where they most needed help, in their relations with God and with each other. He was the friend of the poor, the sick in body and mind, and of the outcast. He proclaimed the dawn of a new age in which love, instead of fear, hatred, and greed, would rule the lives of men. And he went about enlisting men as citizens of that new age. But he forced his teachings and convictions on no one. Compulsion was completely foreign to his spirit. Why then would men want him dead? And it's the answer to that question that we've been pursuing for all these weeks. And the question refuses to go away, even as the drama was unfolding. One grown man broke down in uncontrollable sobs at the crowing of a rooster. A Roman official by the name of Pilate asked in bewilderment, "Why are you wanting to execute him? What evil has he done?" And later on that morning, he washed his hands, called for a bowl of water, and washed his hands, saying, "I want nothing to do with this matter." It caused a centurion to stand at the base of the cross and express a childlike faith. Surely this was a good man, a righteous man. Surely this was the Son of God. It caused the multitude to steal away to their homes, beating their breasts. "And I will pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and supplication. They will look on me, the one they have pierced, and they will mourn as one mourns for an only child, and grieve bitterly for him as one grieves for a firstborn son. On that day the weeping in Jerusalem will be great, like the weeping of Hadad-Rimon in the plain of Megiddo. The land will mourn, each clan by itself, with their wives by themselves, the clan of the house of David and their wives, the clan of the house of Nathan and their wives, the clan of the house of Levi and their wives, and the clan of Shimei and their wives, and all the rest of the clans and their wives by themselves." In that day, all social intercourse was interrupted. According to Zechariah, on that day, all sexual interaction ceased. Each clan was separated by itself. Each family was even divided as the husbands from their wives. It seemed as though, according to Zechariah and according to the record, that everyone recoiled and withdrew into themselves at the horribleness of this that had taken place. One man committed suicide. There are several chief characters, several main characters in the drama. This last man to whom I refer was named Judas Iscariot. He was from a little village called Cariath. This man's part in this drama is the most difficult to understand. The death of Jesus is not usually called an assassination, and yet that's precisely what it was. And Judas is the assassin. Judas murdered Jesus of Nazareth just as surely as if he had taken a knife and plunged it into his heart. He denied him, he betrayed him, and turned him over to people who feared Jesus and hated him. And the people to whom Judas delivered Jesus, Judas knew that they would kill him. The fact that Jesus was betrayed is a matter of history. The reasons why he was betrayed elude us, especially when it comes to Judas. What makes the death of Jesus a much deeper mystery is the fact that the one that betrayed him was one of his own disciples. This is what shocked the 12 whenever Jesus told them that last night, "One of you is going to betray me." And they looked at each other in startled amazement and started asking, "Is it I?" Judas was one of the chosen 12 who had traveled with Jesus, who had been instructed by Jesus, who had slept with Jesus, who had eaten with Jesus, who had been trained to teach and to preach and to heal like Jesus himself was doing. The question simply will not go away. Why did he do it? There are several theories. Number one, he betrayed him, some people say, because Jesus' death was essential. It was necessary. And Judas, in a sense, was just a puppet of God, that he had no choice, that he was used as God would use an instrument, and that Judas had no say as to whether or not he would be that instrument. That leaves us in a dilemma of the human will and the freedom of it. Another theory is that Judas was actually super enthusiastic for this new age, and that Judas's betrayal of Jesus was nothing more than pushing Jesus into a corner to expose him so that he would act as the Messiah that Judas knew him to be, and that Jesus would get on with the program, that Jesus was acting too slowly and they weren't going on as they should, and the kingdom was not coming as it should. And so Judas exposed Jesus, in a sense, to make him go ahead and get busy with it. A third, is that Judas was only a puppet of Satan. And there's some passages that make us perhaps think that that's right. It says that Satan entered Judas, and that after he had entered him, Judas went out and made the contract with the Jewish officials. But that takes upon itself the theory that releases Judas from responsibility for what he did. And there are many conflicting factors in this whole scene that we'll never be able to harmonize. I don't know how to harmonize the fact of free will with the prophecy that said that this is what would happen, and that the amount of money was predicted, that it would be 30 pieces of silver, and that the men who crucified him would say certain things and do certain things. I don't know how to harmonize all of that with free will. I just don't know how, and I don't intend to try this morning. But one theory that's been espoused by a Jewish rabbi by the name of Jacob Golub, in a book that he wrote for Jewish high school students called In the Days of the Second Temple, he says that, in effect, Judas was not a traitor. Judas was rather a patriot who ceased to be hypnotized by the new teaching. And as a faithful member of the Jewish community, he recognized how dangerously revolutionary this new teaching was. That if it was allowed to spread into the Jewish community at large, it would spell the end of Judaism. And that Judas, as this patriot, realized and made his choice that he would be a faithful Jew and would remain faithful to what he'd been taught and for what had been taught for 14 centuries. And he did what he did because of that. But why would he commit suicide? Why would he take his own life? A later historian in the second or third century says that Judas hanged himself outside his own house and that his body was crushed by a passing wagon up and mashed up against the wall. I'm not sure where they got that information. The Bible just simply says that he went out and hanged himself and that he swelled up and burst and that his entrails spilled out on the ground. That implies that he hanged there for long enough for his body to putrefy, as though no one would touch him, no one would dare, and that he hanged there long enough and people would pass by and see his body hanging there from that limb until the putrefaction process caused him to swell and burst. He went out and hanged himself. I think Judas was torn between commitment to the old and a commitment to the new. And for nearly 3 years, the commitment to the new was compelling, and Jesus himself was compelling. And Judas was caught up in it, and Judas himself committed himself. Judas abandoned his home. He abandoned whatever else that he had, and he committed himself to this man. He was respected enough by Jesus and the other disciples that they appointed him as their treasurer. But then when it came down to the fork in the road, and it came down to some kind of something that didn't quite match up in Judas's mind, Judas took his stand with the old guard and decided he would take matters into his own hand. But in the finish, he couldn't live by what he espoused. And he knew that he had denied innocent blood, and he couldn't stand it. And he took the 30 pieces of silver. When he saw that they were going to execute Jesus, they were going to actually put him to death by crucifixion. He knew this gentle man. He knew that he didn't deserve that. And he went frantically looking for the officials with whom he had made the contract. And not finding them in the ordinary places, he burst into the holy place. The word used there means he broke in, not the Holy of Holies, but he broke into the holy place where no one but priests were allowed. He burst in there and began to backtrack and say, "I've betrayed innocent blood. Take the money back." And they said, "That's none of our concern. That's your business." And he took the money and he threw it down. And he went out and in utter despair, tied a rope around his neck and committed suicide. The other characters in the drama and their motives are fairly clear-cut and easy to define, and we'll not spend a lot of time on it. Simon Peter, his faith failed. He just wasn't as strong as he thought he was. Oh, he had said, "I'll go with you to death. The others may deny you, but I'll never deny you." And yet when it came down to choosing between his own life and the life of Jesus of Nazareth, he went for the preservation of his own skin. He later regretted it, thank God. But temporarily, the question haunted him and he ignored it and went on record as having denied Jesus. Caiaphas and the religious rulers, Pilate says he knew that it was because of envy that they had delivered him up. Jesus said, "You do not have the love of God in your hearts." And John later in an editorial note said, "They love the praise of men more than they love the praise of God." What about Pilate? Pilate's political career was at stake. His job was at stake. His life may have been at stake. Because when the Jewish people said, "If you turn this man loose, you're no friend of Caesar's," they threw down the gauntlet. Pilate was pushed into a corner and decided that he would side with his job and with his own safety. What about the soldiers? They were just carrying out orders. What about the Jewish people that cried, "Crucify him! Crucify him! Away with this man!" Well, they were just pawns. They were just pawns set up by their own leaders, carried away by the moment, the emotion of a mob. And these people, no doubt many of them, went home after the event itself, beating their breasts, Luke records. There was one other main character behind the scenes, invisible, but definitely involved, and whose part gives the event meaning and purpose. And that was the one to whom this dying man referred to as my father. My father. And he repeatedly, I don't know how many times during his personal ministry, he referred to my father. I do know that in the last night recorded in those few chapters in John, Jesus referred to my father 51 times at least within a period of 2 or 3 hours. 51 times on the last evening. It's recorded. However many other times, I don't know. But he is the other main character in this drama. And it is to this one of whom this dying man made reference to my father, and of whom he said to his disciples, all of you will betray me tonight. You'll all be scattered, and you will leave me alone. But he says, I'm not alone. My Father is with me. I'm not alone. Jesus, if he knew anything at all, and if we know anything about him, he was aware that he was doing his Father's will. He believed it to the innermost part of his being. He said, I am doing what my Father has commanded me to do. I am laying down my life because my Father asked me to, and I'm doing what he wants. In the garden, he prayed 3 times to be released from this responsibility. But each time he would say, not my will, Father, but yours be done. So he knew at the very innermost part of his being that he was doing the will of his Father. But something must have happened. Something that was unplanned, something that is perhaps unexplained, certainly it was unexpected. Somehow or other, Jesus got a surprise because he asks his Father this same question. Why? Why have you forsaken me? All of his friends had left him, but he said, I'm not alone. And then in the midst of this horrible scene. This man screamed out, my God, why have you forsaken me? As though he were surprised. I don't know whether it was because he was surprised at the enormity of the weight of the burden of the sins. I don't know whether it was because of the extremity of the cost. But here, for the first time, as far as we have any record, for the first time in Jesus' life, he was aware that he was alone. He was not with his Father. That his Father had turned his back on him. I don't think he was prepared for that. I don't think he understood it until it happened. Why else would he have cried out with as limited a supply of air as he had in his lungs? Why would he scream, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani? Why would he cry that? I think he was shocked at the extremity of the cost he was being called upon to pay. 2 poems help us understand this mystery and answer the question why. One of them is from the Jewish writings themselves. That passage that the Jewish nation has excluded from their assemblies, excluded from their feasts, that we referred to 2 Sundays ago, the 53rd chapter of Isaiah. Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender plant, like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him. Nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. Like one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted, but he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before his shearer is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and who can speak of his descendants? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was stricken. He was assigned a grave with the wicked, and with the rich man in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors. For he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors, thus opening up for us a new and living way through the veil which was his flesh. That's a statement made in reflection by one of the writers of the Christian writings. Having therefore, brethren, boldness to enter into the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he has consecrated for us through the veil, that is to say, his flesh. The other day there was a poem that was read, and this is the second poem that I want to read you to help us understand what happened. Once there was a holy place, evidence of God's embrace, and I can almost see mercy's face pressed against the veil. Looking down with longing eyes, mercy must have realized that once his blood was sacrificed, freedom would prevail. And as the sky grew dark and the earth began to shake, with justice no longer in the way, mercy came running like a prisoner set free, past all my failures to the point of my need. When the sin that I carried was all I could see, and when I could not reach mercy, mercy came running to me. Once there was a broken heart, way too human from the start, and all the years left it torn apart, hopeless and afraid. Walls I never meant to build left this prisoner unfulfilled. Freedom called, but even still it seemed so far away. I was bound by the chains from the wages of my sin. Just when I felt like giving in, mercy came running like a prisoner set free, past all my failures to the point of my need. When the sin that I carried was all I could see, when I could not reach mercy, mercy came running to me. And so our trek ends with the crucifixion of this man, Jesus of Nazareth, and mercy came running to us.